Welcome to Writers on Writing here on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. You are tuned in live. Barbara DeMarco Barrett is joining us from Palm Springs at a media retreat. And we've also got author Tom Payne on the line. Barbara, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Awesome. Tom, are you here?
I'm here.
Excellent. Okay. Go for it.
Thanks, Deb. Yes, you are listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM, broadcasting actually from the University of California, Irvine, and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I'm, as Deb said, here in Palm Springs, and thanks to her, we're airing the show anyway, with her being the engineer there at the studio,
and she
has Tom Payne on the line. Tom is author of The Pearl of Kuwait. 3 years after the publication of Scar Vegas, his award-winning collection, he returns with a novel about the Gulf War. And after reading Tom Payne's book, Phil Caputo said, "It was a brilliant stroke creating an Amerasian hero, the bastard son of one war fighting in another war, to illustrate everything that is good, bad, and a little loco about the American character. I haven't had this much fun reading a novel in years." Tom's collection of short stories, Scar Vegas, was a finalist for the Hemingway Foundation Pen Award and an American Library Association Top 10 Book of the Year and a New York Times Notable Book of the Year. His fiction has been published in The New Yorker, Harper's, and Playboy. He's a graduate of Princeton and the Columbia MFA program. He teaches at Middlebury College in Vermont, and this is his second time being on the show. Hi, Tom.
Hi, Barbara. It's good to be back.
Great to have you on. This book, it's been garnering wonderful reviews. It's just a hoot, and I wonder if you would talk about how it came about.
Well, it's really a complexity of reasons I think it came about, but the easiest one is that I sort of became obsessed in a writerly sort of unconscious level with the war when my college roommate, among other Marines I knew, were in the war. And I was a journalist at the time. And I would see them after the war, and I'd correspond during the war and as best I could. And something in me just knew that this was my generation's war, if that makes sense, and that somehow I wanted to write about it. I was, 7, 8, 9 during the Vietnam era, and that was the war for my older cousins and older friends, but this was sort of my generation's war, and something just clicked when my friend was in, especially when I talked to him, and he came back and told such extraordinary stories, which seemed, over the top and hilarious the way he told them, and often tragic underneath the hilarity, which was sort of his way of storytelling.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I remember when you were on a couple of years ago with your first book, Scar Vegas, the collection of short stories. I recall you saying something to the effect of that it was all well and good that you had a collection of short stories, but you were being pressured to write a novel. Do you recall that?
Sure, and it's true.
So, and now you've written a wonderful novel. In terms of, the short form and the long form, how was it? How was it writing a novel after really, it sounded like you were pretty committed to being a short story writer?
Well, I was pretty committed because I sort of thought that's, you sort of absorb your understanding of the literary world by osmosis, and that was my understanding of what you did, and I also loved the short story, so I thought I played that sort of minor league ball, if you will, pretty well, but I also sort of wanted to stay in that game, but the publishing world also was nice enough to give me a two-book contract and ask for a novel. As to the experience, the hardest thing, and it's sort of simplistic, but the hardest thing about writing the novel, I didn't find it harder or easier. The hardest thing was, as been said before, I think it's like running a marathon. It took 3 years. And so you kind of have to, it's harder to keep the faith over the long haul. I mean, you're researching one small part of it, or you're fiddling with whole chapters or whole sections that you work on for a month or two, and then they're gone. You know you have to kill them at a certain point.
Yeah.
And keeping the belief in a short story, in theory, you can knock out the framework over the weekend or something and know you think you have something.
Mm-hmm.
And if it doesn't work, it's a weekend. But keeping the faith over 3 years, when you're sort of running on empty, sometimes financially,
so
you
how
have other
do
pressures,
you do that?
That gets sort of tricky.
Yeah, how do you do that? How do you keep it going when, you know, when you hit the low tide of writing and you just go, oh, man, this is, you know, I'm 2 years into this. It's not done yet.
Yeah, my response to that was always, if I did hit a wall, either creatively or financially, well, let me talk creatively, I would ask myself why I was getting bored.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the feeling of boredom was often a trigger that I had to do something that would tickle me and interest me. And I say tickle, it sounds frivolous, but tickle me also on a deeper level.
Mm-hmm.
Financially, it's almost like knock on wood because I got lucky here and there. But really, in comparison to how I lived or tried to live when I was younger, I try to be a little more secure. Now I've been sort of flying blind and, you know, knowing that the bank account is just drip, drip, dripping away.
Yes.
And then hoping that something happens, but continuing to just work for the hell of it,
yeah.
I guess.
Will you read to us?
Oh, sure.
And if you just tuned in, you are listening to Writers on Writing. I am talking today with Tom Paine, who is author of The Pearl of Kuwait, published by Harcourt. Okay.
Okay. I've never read this section. This is the basic idea of the novel is that a young guy, Tommy Trang, who's Amerasian, falls in love before the first Gulf War with a Kuwaiti princess. And the novel is sort of a rescue of the princess story on the surface in that he goes back and he goes AWOL with his best friend, Cody Carmichael, who's the narrator.
Mm-hmm.
And they sneak into Kuwait to rescue Princess Lou, who's trapped in there, and sort of she's linked up with the Kuwaiti resistance. And this is the scene I never read. Very much toward the back of the book, where they're returning to link up with Princess Lulu once again. And Tommy Trang's has a sort of revelation as he goes along. He sort of has a series of revelations, but I hope it explains itself to some degree.
Okay.
We crawled out of the mountain of garbage bags after dark, and we hoof our way through the alleys and back streets toward Princess Lulu, and we find her at Caleb's villa. And I was wondering how Princess Lulu was going to take Tommy Trang's brand spanking new plan, as he explained it to me, to, like, dump the Kuwaiti and Saudi royal families ASAP in favor of democracy. So we march into the villa, and the first thing we see on the marble floor is this fine-looking flamingo, looking in the pink of health, so to speak. And Princess Lulu comes out and pretty much wings herself through the air into the arms of Tommy Trang. And he wings her around, and it was fine to see this much, like, international love in front of your eyes. And when Lulu and Trang are done spinning and generally surfing the stoke of gripping each other tight, Princess Lulu gives me and little Ali hugs and kisses too. And then she like falls to her knees and starts quietly crying. Because I guess even with her huge faith in Allah's big plan generally, a minor part of Princess Lulu wasn't totally sure she'd ever see us three again. And I didn't think about it at the time, but this crying was like the first little crack in Lulu's loss of faith in Allah's big plan when it came to maybe losing Tommy Trang in heroic battle. But since we were back safe and sound, Princess Lulu was pretty soon up off her knees and back into talking about Allah's big plans for all of us. And her and Trang were so excited to talk to each other, they did that you talk first thing. And then Tommy Trang, like, looked Princess Lulu in the eye and said straight out, you know, I think we should dump the king thing here and in Saudi too. Now, as Princess Lulu was a princess, you might have thought she would have a big problem with this idea. But right away she starts nodding and looking at me saying, that's exactly Allah's plan. Apparently she had gotten the word from above, while we had gone to Kafji, that Allah's big plan for us all, as signified by Allah sending the flamingo to replace the dead maid Leela, is that we should bring some democratic reforms to all of Kuwait. I mean, in those days, Lulu still pretty much figured everything was like Allah's plan, and it took her a while to figure out Allah probably didn't want democracy in Kuwait. She wanted democracy in Kuwait, and the reason she wanted democracy was because she knew at some level that only in a democracy would she be free to get it on in peace with the infidel Tommy Trang. So to recap, at this point in Lulu's 16-year-old life, she still had to think it was old Allah talking to her about democracy and not her own American-style common sense. Want me to stop there?
Thank you so much. That was Tom Paine reading from The Pearl of Kuwait. As I was listening, I was thinking about about the first-person voice of the novel's narrator, of Cody Carmichael. And I was curious how you found it, how you located it, how you decided that this novel would be first-person, present tense.
Well, this is like the fourth or fifth draft of this book. And the earlier ones, you know, I tried different voices. And what I really wanted to do was to write an enthusiastic novel, a sort of effervescent novel, a novel that had some of both in from my own life, had some of the energy of the kids I grew up with and the kids I've known in my life.
Yes.
You know, just sort of rambunctious American, sometimes stupid energy with a lot of creativity and a lot of chutzpah. And I hung around beaches and so forth, and there was something about this California vernacular. I did it as best as I could. That captured that American innocence and enthusiasm. Some might say stupidity, but that's why I liked it, because it was my own way of sort of writing a Kerouacian book, in the sense that his voice has so much sort of beatific, rushing energy.
I'm always curious how authors write their books in terms of plot outlines, in terms of how much they know when they're beginning. And with this book, how much did you know? Did you had your starting place? Did you know where you were headed?
Not really. It sort of comes to you, or it comes to me, in snatches. And a snatch can even be a word. But it seems that one thing that I've noticed other writers have the capacity to do is they're pretty good at implications of things. So that if you give them one word, they can tell you three web-like possibilities that have to occur from that word. For example, when I knew the kid's name, that he was Tommy Trang and that he was Amerasian, or that he was a product of the Vietnam War, there's a host of possible, of, you know, hundreds of possible thread-like connections that come out of the word Vietnam. And for me, all words are sort of have all sorts of thread-like connections, like the Gulf War.
Yeah.
Things that I've read, things that I've heard, anecdotes that I've been told. But I did a lot of research talking to Marines for this book. And so the process for me is sort of linking together in a pattern. And so part of it's pulling out what's already sort of in your own unconscious based on the words.
Mm-hmm.
And the little glimpses you get, and then pinning them together, and slowly, it occurred to me what the plot was.
So you started writing without necessarily knowing.
Oh yeah.
Uh huh.
I mean, I wrote the first two or three drafts. The first couple of drafts had no Tommy Trang, the hero, in it. Speaking of faith earlier, and that's why it takes a certain amount of faith, because you really have to be willing to fall on your face and stumble around, and it's really much, much more chaotic, at least for me and the other writers, some of the other writers I've talked to, than we ever let on to the PhDs, if you know what I mean.
Okay, so then you had your novel, or you had your, what I imagine you considered your final draft. Is that the point where you sent it to your editor at Harcourt?
Yeah.
And then what?
Well, actually, at one point she asked for 100 pages, and I was a bit beyond that, so I sent that to her. And then she said okay and paid me some, and then I handed in the whole thing later.
Mm-hmm. And so, in terms of the editing process, did the book pretty much, I mean, do you feel, just in terms of working with editors, that they help you bring out, or she helped you bring out the best of the book? Did there come times when you just didn't want to do something that, or make a change that perhaps she wanted, and then how do you deal with that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, she wanted it to be 150 to 200 pages shorter than it was.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, and you know, that was sort of, you should do this. She was kind about it. I suppose she would have accepted it if I handed it back. I'm not sure, but I ended up not cutting what she wanted me to cut. She wanted the middle cut, and I cut off a lot of the end.
Mm-hmm.
Instead, most of our interactions were verbal, like sort of discussing the people as if they were you or I.
Yes.
Or characters, people that we knew, just sort of gut reactions to the people.
So then you cut what you wanted, and she was basically happy with that it had gotten to the length that she wanted? I mean, I would imagine after the reviews started coming and you've gotten such sterling reviews that you know, whatever questions she may have had in terms of if you did the right thing must have been proven that you did the right thing.
Well, I mean, not all the reviews were all that good. So she might still think I did the wrong thing. I'm not sure. She very well might. But, you know, she always repeated at the end of every one of our sessions, you know, this is your book.
Yeah.
Which was kind. So I'm not really sure.
Mm-hmm. And you are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm talking with Tom Paine, author of The Pearl of Kuwait, published by Harcourt. I said this to you in an email, I think it was, that the cover is so intensely gorgeous. Do you feel the same? Do you like the cover? Was this, and did you know it was going to look like this?
Well, yeah, because they send you your cover.
Mm-hmm.
Beforehand. I thought the cover was pretty good. I was teaching at Warren Wilson recently, and there were a bunch of which is a MFA program, and there were a lot of writers sitting around. And I don't think any of the writers were all that pleased with their covers.
Mm-hmm.
I think every writer has a very particular part of the novel that, or you know, a vision, and they have a visual vision because writers are pretty visual.
Yes.
So I thought it was a really, you know, eye-catching cover, but as
what,
I said, I think...
what is the cover, Tom? This is
what?
Debbie here in Irvine. What does the cover look like? For all of
well, you remember Dr. Strangelove?
Yes.
With the guy riding the rocket?
Uh-huh.
Well, it has a Arab, a girl, well, she doesn't actually look Arab if you look really close.
A princess.
She's supposed to be the princess, I believe, sort of riding a Scud missile.
Ooh,
and,
I like it.
That was the problem I had, because it was before the actual Second Gulf War occurred, and I was pretty sure it was coming. And I said to them, you know, that's a Scud missile, and there might be another Gulf War, and they're not going to be funny if they start lobbing them at Israel.
Right.
Which might have been too much forethought. And also I thought, a lot of my friends were like, what the heck is that, a burning cigarette or worse?
Well, I love that on the spine, there's the title, The Pearl of Kuwait, Tom Paine, and then below, just above the Harcourt logo, is a camel.
Yeah, I love that camel. It's going to be on the paperback.
I love this camel.
They have a, and that's more, yeah, the camel is just sort of giving this quizzical look on the paperback to the reader, sort of like, you know, what's up with this war? What the heck's with these infidels roaming around Arabia? Because that was really the fun of the thing for me. You know, it's pretty nasty times right now, post 9/11, but and maybe it's my Irish American extraction, but I really, the more I read about Islam and the more I read about this war and the more I talked to people in the war, for myself, there was a hell of a lot of humor in it.
Yeah.
Just the absurdities and the stupidities, you know, as I used the word earlier, they sort of tickled me. And when I read the book, sort of judge whether I was doing an okay job, whether I started to crack up a bit, whether my sense of humor is juvenile or something. remains to be seen. I mean, it, you know, to be frank, you were nice enough to say the reviews were great, but I think the
I've
reviews
seen so
sort
many
of
put, that are wonderful.
What?
I don't think I've seen the bad ones.
They weren't. I think it boiled down to a lot of the people who didn't, the few people who didn't like it had trouble with these boys being so outrageously gung-ho in wanting to do basically in a junior version what George Bush, by coincidence, wanted to do in Gulf War II. At least that was their state. As they get over there, they want to bring democracy and repeat my own books.
Mm-hmm.
And it took, the mechanical sense of learning to write took a lot longer before, after I, to my mind, conquered the basics, that I was actually realizing, oh my God, now I'm trying to do, that's it. I should try to do on the page what they did. The final step was trying to capture the spirit, if you see.
Mm.
You know, it's like if you get better and better at tennis, at a certain point it becomes theoretically sort of a spiritual thing. practice, if you will, mm-hmm. once you've got all the mechanics.
Right, exactly. I play tennis, Tom.
Okay, good. Then you get the
yes.
comparison.
Mm-hmm. And I never got to that point.
No, I didn't either, but I hear people do. But
you're
I think
to Writers on Writing,
yeah.
and we're talking with Tom Paine, author of The Pearl of Kuwait. How are we doing, Deb?
Well, we're ready to take a break, and Tom will be back with us after the break.
Excellent. So stay tuned, and we'll be back with more Tom Paine.
Listening to Writers on Writing here at KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Welcome back.
And hello, I am Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and today we're talking with Tom Paine, author of The Pearl of Kuwait, published by Harcourt, with a beautiful cover. It is. It's so gorgeous. I just love looking at this cover, the yellow and the blue and the red. It's just, you know, Harcourt has some wonderful art directors
and
artists, I think.
They do.
It's really, some of their books are so incredible looking. Anyway, I wanted to ask you, because I don't think I ever have, if you have any sort of rituals or things that you do when you start writing. If you do, if there's anything you do to kind of put yourself in the mood, or do you just simply have a time every day that you know you're going to write and you just sit down and that's it?
Well, what happened in this, with this book is I used to be a person who would sort of stumble around and take a lot of time and fiddle with this and that before actually trying to accomplish something. And then the book became pretty overdue. It was about a year late, and my editor said, you know, you got to show us something. So I set myself a schedule of, because I'd already written several drafts, but I wasn't happy with them, of writing 5 pages a day. So I did that, and I just, the ritual was just sort of checking off the calendar each day with an X if I had actually accomplished 5 pages. You know, and I'd try to write 5 pages that I was happy with, of
mm-hmm.
course. But that was the only ritual, mostly because I didn't really have time for rituals because I had sort of fiddled around and kept praying that that something would occur to me,
mm-hmm.
Some sort of spark that would like put it over the top, so to speak, in my own head, so that I could just roar on through.
So what I'm wondering. I mean, you know, the delay was that a delay that came more from you wanted this book to be perfect? Was you know. Where does that come from?
Well, I hadn't thought of myself as having too much cowardice when it came to writing, and I really sort of never really understood the people who say writing takes so much bravery, and, you know, when it said sort of falsely, it always didn't really work with me. But I was researching this book endlessly for a year and then into the second year, and I spent, you know, as my wife will point out, about $800 on the Internet buying $3 books from Malta and all over the globe on the war, looking for sort of anecdotal details. So I was never putting pen to paper for a long time, or I was doing it sort of haphazardly because I guess I was procrastinating. But I was procrastinating thinking that it was all going to, that there was a secret key that was going to unlock it for me. And eventually that did occur when I thought of this, the fact that this, when this kid's name came to me, really, when I was lying in bed, his name came originally as Tran, and then it got changed to Trang, which is a Vietnamese girl's first name, like Rose or something,
mm-hmm.
Which is explained in the book why he changed it. But that was the key, when I realized that the kid was the product of Vietnam.
And at what point was that?
That was well into it. I had written a couple of drafts without a Vietnamese kid. He was a product of Vietnam War, and that his father was the unknown U.S. Marine who had raped his mother, and then he becomes he's Amerasian and he comes to America. And that was pretty far along. I mean, I've been sort of flirting with the idea, and then I just said, yeah, what the hell?
Mm-hmm.
That, because it's the excitement. When I came up with that, I was like, that's pretty exciting, but can I really do that? And that's when I knew, when you get really excited, I think that's the storyteller's... for myself, when I really say to myself, God, can I really get away with that? Could that really be the case?
Mm-hmm.
Is that possible?
Mm-hmm.
Then there's a natural sort of energy in it. And rather than racing from it, you sort of say, well, what the hell?
Mm-hmm.
Let me check it out. Let me see if it'll work. And you start to talk to people. I actually met a couple who were from Vietnam, and they asked me to take their picture once, and I followed them around to ask them questions, and God, I asked them, could a kid who was Amerasian, a negative product of the Vietnam War, turn out to be this sort of gung-ho, totally flag-waving American? And to my surprise, because I sort of already established the character on the paper at that point, they were like, absolutely, and they were telling me about their relatives in Orange County who pretty much told me about kids like Tommy Trang, and horrible stories of people who had escaped from Vietnam after the war, and yet still became totally traditionalist Americans,
mm-hmm.
Had a sense of the original values or dreams of America. And so that was really, those sort of coincidences are really cool when they occur.
So you said that you thought, what did you say here? I think I jotted it down, that you thought that there was a secret key, that
right.
you were procrastinating, thinking there was a secret key. Is this the key you're talking about, or are you talking about just, you know, why, you know, what's the key to sitting down here and wanting to get this done?
Well, I think the secret key is that you have to be satisfied. I mean, I could have sat down and wrote a novel
mm-hmm.
at any point there. I could have banged out a novel, I think, under duress, but I wanted to be thrilled.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to be excited and know that I was on a plank that was heading across a river that was exciting to me. And when I came up with that kid, the hero, whether he is, you know, to everybody, I don't know, that was the key in the sense that reassured me at least for myself, I was really turned on. That was the energy that sort of vitalized all the disparate little anecdotal, poetical details that I had accumulated. And he just, when I got that, it was like Zorba the Greek. I mean, his vitality just sort of, for me, pumped up the, made it possible.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after college, I was sort of lost, and I was I was working in a psych hospital, and I got way into reading Carl Jung.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have much to do with Freud, but when I read Carl Jung and how he responded to sort of the artistic impulse, and he would tell stories about, you know, this sort of psychotherapy sessions when a hummingbird, which actually just flew by me right now, would come into the room, and it would sort of become a key or a signifier in whatever therapeutic thing was going on, and sort of unleash and open the door of all the patterns that had gone before and all their mm-hmm. endless talking in a therapy session.
Yeah.
That's sort of like what Trang did for this novel. He sort of, by coincidence, popped into my head, and I was like, it just filled me with energy. And I was confident.
That leads into another question. But first let me say to listeners who have just tuned in, you're a little bit late. You've missed like a wonderful show and a wonderful author. But I'm talking with Tom Paine, author of The Pearl of Kuwait, published by Harcourt. Now, say you hadn't been under contract to write this book, to turn this book in. Because I think writers abandon ideas all the time. I think they start books, start stories, and 100 pages in, 200 pages in, put them aside. They've lost steam. Say you hadn't had a contract. What do you think would have happened? Is it your personality structure that you have to finish what you start, and you would have found this key? Or what do you think? I mean, what is it when you don't have, say, a contract that keeps you going or doesn't?
Well, I think the writers that I've met, I think many of them are really both creative, but they're also deeply pragmatic. Not all the poets I've met, but a lot of the fiction writers have had this weird streak of deep pragmatism and the ability to look sort of reality square in the eye, and also flighty creativity. And if I can answer the question that way, I think I would have, I'm hesitant to say I would have continued and written the novel without a contract, in that I feel that I really got lucky.
Mm-hmm.
So on the one hand, there's a practical part of me that would have quit if it was just not working, and there's also a practical part of me that might have pushed on, but I think I would have written it anyway. I'm pretty sure I would have written it anyway, without a contract, because for 12 or 14 years or whatever it was, I knew that I was wanted to write about this war. But the part of me that's hesitant to totally say I would have done it, even though I believe that the plotting, practical part of my nature would have pushed ahead.
Mm-hmm.
So much of writing is just lucky. Like you're just looking for one book and you find another book. You're talking to one person when you're researching, because this, as I said, took some research, and you meet another person, or you're lying in bed and all the jumble of details you have mixes around, and you know who's in charge of what pops to the surface.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know how Trang's name popped to the surface. I can trace it back to I can trace the narrator's back to one line in one USA Today book. It was like snapshots of different soldiers in the Gulf in the war, and it was about this happy. It literally said this happy-go-lucky skateboarder kid from California. And I read tons of stuff about the war, and I bypassed that detail, and yet that detail saved me all the time. And so he became a surfer later. So it's a very long-winded, and perhaps it didn't totally answer your question.
What was the one line?
The one line was in this book, and it was just a description of this this kid who was a blonde-haired, happy-go-lucky California kid who just wanted to ride a skateboard, who was over there in the war.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, God, you know, I never really thought about some happy-go-lucky California kid who would just rather be home skateboarding to some degree over there in the Gulf War.
Mm-hmm.
And but I bypassed it at the time for months, if not a year, and yet over, as compared to all the weighty tomes I read, that one little detail sort of stayed with me.
Mm-hmm.
So, but that isn't, I mean, to go back to your answer, I think I would have plotted ahead, because I think most people can write a novel, have a certain plotting nature, because you have to write a page or half a page or five pages or whatever and stick with it. You can't be too flighty. But as I tried to also say, it takes a lot of openness.
What do you do with students, then, who you see and believe and or absolutely know have talent, and they have so little confidence in themselves? How do you, or do you, get them to just, you know, kind of override the insecurities and go for it? You know, I see that all the time. Some of the most talented writers are the most insecure, and, you know, you can almost see them, you know, toying with the idea of, can I stop doing this? Because I'll never be any good, where you want to say, you're great, you just have to keep doing it.
Right. Well,
because I'm not sure that plotting nature type of thing happens at the beginning. You know, it's like, it's almost like somewhere along the line you have to develop enough trust in yourself to allow yourself to keep doing it, to
right.
develop that nature.
Well, I might have
persevering.
I might have said this to you, and I'm not sure if this totally addresses your same. I think it does. Back when we talked last, but I think every time that when I was writing short stories and they're getting rejected for 10 years or so, that I got a nasty rejection letter, or just you know the 10 years. Every time, there are many, many times when you think of quitting,
mm-hmm.
and you do quit. You know, quit and say to hell with this. And I tried being an advertising copywriter and. Tried any number of other jobs, and then I became a journalist and sort of quit fiction for 5 or 6 years. But every time that you quit, if it's really there,
mm-hmm.
you know, the calling, and I think I've read this elsewhere in, like, the Paris Review interviews, that the same thing I think that I'm saying, that I think if it's there, you get knocked down, and it's to your betterment sometimes, not always.
Mm-hmm.
And then you get up, and you're like, you know, I really do care about this. I really do want to do this, and nobody's going to get in my way, and you sort of have a renewed strength, ideally.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that might have just been my personality, but I think, you know, I remember William Kennedy said something like that in those same interviews, that, you know, what separated him out and other people that have sort of gone on to publish is perseverance, the word you used, just because they won't take no. But very mm-hmm. often, before you say, I'm not going to take no, you just simply say, well, you sort of say, screw that, or
mm-hmm.
you get pretty pissed, and you condemn everyone that read it or didn't read it. And but as to my students, I just try to underline and point out the parts that have vitality and have the juice, so to speak, and that are fun. And sometimes, it at least where I've been teaching, it seems to vitalize them because I think they say to themselves, hell, that's what the teacher likes. I can do that. That was the easy part.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? Well, they thought they were doing it really well in some other section. I'll be like, no, this is actually writing. This stuff that you just sort of threw off the cuff that's descriptive and vital, and it actually is just sort of intrinsically interesting to a human being. This is writing. Do more of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I have found, at least in this last class that I was talking about, that when people were aware of what, for me, was the basis of good writing. You know,
Tom, I want to let our listeners know this is Writers on Writing. Tom Payne's the guest. Barbara DeMarco Barrett is live from Palm Springs, calling from a media retreat there. I want more questions or more
And I'm
answers.
Very damp.
Oh, you lucky lady. But I want more advice for beginning writers, burgeoning writers who are just building up their confidence. Obviously, you now have a history of writing and you're established, Tom. And when you are writing good, you know, just feeling the dynamic in your work and the energy and vitality, what qualities does your work possess? And in contrast to that, maybe you could highlight some writer's sins that might show up in work that's not working so well. Things that are obvious of good work and bad work that you've seen.
Well, the easiest way for me to tell good work is if very often in class I'll say, you know, this isn't working to some degree. I'll try to be kind about it. And I'll say, just, you know, tell me something. Tell your class. These are 18-year-olds. Tell the class something. Go around the room and tell us something that happened to you this weekend, you know. And I think the response of the class to certain stories is palpable. It's obvious. If everybody laughs or if everybody looks really serious, then you've hooked them, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is the quality of good writing. And not always. It can be false, and it can be a trick and all. But very often, if you're hooked, because the humanness in you responds just out of curiosity and out of compassion or simpatico feeling for the characters, if you're hooked, then that's good writing. And, you know, there have been writers throughout history who are clumsy physical writers. But you're hooked by their writing, and to answer a totally different way,
mm-hmm.
is many writers, many young writers, they write like essayistic stuff, and in the simplest mechanical way, it's pretty easy to go through and circle all the places where they're actually writing about physical things, because you're a camera, you're mm-hmm. showing, you know, not always, but in my kind of fiction, and it's certainly, I've seen the same process occur at like Breadloaf and so forth. You're supposed to be talking about the physical world, physical people, and if you just go through someone's work and circle all the physical moments where they described the tree and the car and cut out and just cross out everything else in the most severest case.
Yeah.
What's left is something, and then you read that and you're like, that's the world. That's something that happened. More like that.
Mm-hmm.
Does that sort of answer?
Yeah, absolutely. What about writer's sins? What's bad work? Like things that are just going to stop you in your tracks and pull you away from the story or leave you uninterested. And this can be grammatical, you know, advice as well. Maybe too many adjectives, personal pronouns, anything that stops you in your tracks.
I think that what 80% of the writers, beginning writers, what stops me is that they've all been so well trained, or I'm talking about Middlebury, of course, but in the larger world too, when I like used to read for Breadloaf for the admissions process, 80% of the writers, they're still writing high school essays.
Mm-hmm.
There's a rhetorical stilted quality that a good teacher can snap you out of. Whether in 5 minutes or 5 hours or 5 weeks, it depends. But there's a really rhetorical quality, and I think it's because so many people are trained mostly to write about fiction, you know, to write essays about fiction or to write college papers and so forth. They spend all this time doing that and very little time writing or being taught to write with fresh, active verbs and with concrete nouns and to have physical descriptions of the people and to have the people talk like, by using the writer's ear, like they really would talk if they were friends with you. And so the main fault in all the writing that I've read, the first drafts and the first attempts, or the early attempts, is that it's rhetorical, and that produces a distance between the reality you're supposed to be putting on the page, that there are real damn people there, mm-hmm. and the reader. And some people can do that right away, because they've sort of never had that trained out of them, that freshness. It's sort of like they've never lost the when you write in a diary, you write usually, unless you're real phony. When you write it to yourself in a diary, you write and you tell the truth, and mm-hmm. you write what happened, you know, with Jane or Joe, and you write freshly, naturally. Or when you've had a couple of beers or some wine late at night, and you're calling home or to your beloved that you miss somewhere else or something, and you tend to talk, albeit perhaps drunkenly, but freshly.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And in good writing, there's something that's a little akin to having a couple of glasses of wine.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're sort of cutting the palaver and getting to the fresh thing.
Mm-hmm.
Does that answer?
Yeah,
that's
okay.
A great answer. I love that. You can perhaps pick up a little drunkly, but freshly. I love that. You know, we're at the end of our time, and I want to tell you thank you again for coming on the show.
Oh, I'm grateful.
It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, Barbara. Thanks for having me on.
An interesting way of looking at things, and I always like to hear what that is.
Well, thank you. Thanks for
having me
on.
And you have been listening to Writers on Writing, and we've been with Tom Paine, author of The Pearl of Kuwait, published by Harcourt. And if nothing else, just go look at this book. It's beautiful, okay? It's a beautiful book here. If you have any questions or comments or would like to know about future guests and events in the area, you can visit my website at writersonwriting.com. There you can sign up to be on the mailing list. And I want to thank you again, Debbie, for making it possible for me to go away and still broadcast this show.
My pleasure.
It's been wonderful. Debbie is a public affairs host at KUCI of the Psychic Deli and Fresh Voices,
mm-hmm.
and she's on every week. I'd like to end with a quote by Janet Frame, who said, "All writers are exiles wherever they live, and their work is a lifelong journey towards the lost land." You've been listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM. I'm still Barbara DeMarco Barrett. I'm still damp in Palm Springs. But I thank you for listening, and please stay safe.